The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, December 5th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Out in North Dakota, we can report a story, a victory, in fact, in a battle that, if it had stretched into 2017, could have defined the Trump administration's early days.
Today, the Department of Army, Joe Allen Darcy, contacted me and said the Corps of Engineers is going to deny the easement.
You pray to experience this, but when it actually happened, I don't know what to feel. I really don't. I can't even come up with the words right now.
Joyful protesters from Standing Rock yesterday. That last voice was Brandy King, an Iraq vet who'd come to defend the land with protesters, courtesy of PRI reporter Jasmine Garst. The Army Corps of Engineers said that the pipeline in question will be rerouted to come nowhere near Indian land, and a full environmental impact statement will be done suggesting that the pipeline may never be built at all. Over 2,000 veterans have arrived at the site to act as human shields during any confrontations between police and protesters. Filmmaker Josh Fox returned from his second trip to Standing Rock and was in our studio. He's director of the film Gasland, and victory was all over his face.
Who's giving up? Nobody.
But who's blinking? The government seems to have blinked here.
No, it's not about blinking. This is about resistance actually working. And we've seen this time and time again in the environmental movement, and now for certainly with this indigenous sovereignty struggle with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe combined with climate activists and fracking activists. When we organize, we win. When we put our bodies on the line, we win. When people embody the spirit of peaceful resistance, which you've seen in so many of these historic struggles across history, we win. So that's what's happening today.
Well, in the sacred land argument, they could move the pipeline, and that will deal with that. But the use of the pipeline as a fossil fuel source of our energy doesn't change the environmental equation at all.
Well, I don't know if that's true. I mean, and it remains to be seen. An environmental impact study is something that's really a thing. You know, that takes a while to complete.
So the possibility exists that the pipeline wouldn't be built at all.
I think so. And I think Energy Transfer Partners kind of deserves it for literally bulldozing through their way through sacred lands. I mean, this tribe notified the Energy Transfer Partners that they were approaching a sacred burial ground. And the day that they did that, they accelerated their construction to literally bulldoze it on purpose. And then you saw them defending that with attack dogs, which actually bit protesters. The government of North Dakota, along with Energy Transfer Partners, has been behaving as a rogue establishment without any regard for peace, for safety, certainly for the environment. So when you do that, which is so typical of oil and gas, it is the only thing that's remarkable about this decision is actually sanity has prevailed and the government has actually stood up to the oil and gas industry, which very, very rarely happens. But all credit goes to the peaceful protectors who put themselves on the line to actually block the pipeline physically and did this for months on end while being shot at with rubber bullets and tear gas and mace and pepper spray and water cannons at 20-degree temperatures, exposed to lethal force when they were unarmed and peaceful.
But in terms of the chain of command, the federal government has intervened and overruled the interests at the state level who are much more interested and are much closer to the pipeline company.
Well, I wouldn't say intervened. Again, this is a process. This is a regulatory framework. I mean, the Army Corps of Engineers has that land, and it does so to contain interests that would ordinarily be rapacious towards the environment. Look, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe has a real point when they say this is our only watershed and these pipelines are very dangerous. We've had 3,300 major pipeline leaks in the United States between 2010 and 2015. The Yellowstone River, the Kalamazoo River, the beaches of Santa Barbara, Mayflower, Arkansas, an entire town that had to be abandoned because suburban garages are filling up with crude oil when the pipeline breaks. These things happen very, very frequently. And the reason why is because the pipeline industry, in my humble opinion, is operating in a state of criminal negligence. They do not pay attention to the fact that the regulatory framework is very, very weak, and these guys would rather pollute environments than have to pay extra to make these pipelines safer.
What's the precedent here? What has been seen by the federal government and the Army Corps to have been the supreme law of the land here?
Yeah. Well, I think that the precedent is when a company behaves in the way that Energy Transfer Partners has been doing and literally using the police as their own private security firm. Remember, Kelsey Warren, the billionaire at the head of this pipeline, has offered to reimburse the North Dakota Police Department for their expenses. If that's not hiring, you know, the cops as your own private security force for your billion-dollar environmentally insane oil pipeline project, I don't know what is. So the precedent is when you behave in this way, as the oil industry does very typically throughout the United States, fracking, pipelines, mountaintop removal, all the things that the extractive energy industry does, the precedent is, okay, wait a minute, stop. We're in the 21st century now. You simply can't bulldoze people. You can't run over indigenous rights. You can't run over human rights in your quest, especially now that we don't need oil pipelines, right? We have other technologies. We have wind, we have solar, we have geothermal. We have other ways of producing energy that are far more environmentally friendly, and people want them.
What message was sent by the veterans who showed up over the last few days and really said that this was a constitutional struggle that they fought in Iraq for these values, and they support the native tribes?
What the veterans did was they exposed the deep racism and violence of the North Dakota police force, the Morton County Sheriff's Office, because what they were saying is, you want to shoot at people? You want to shoot at unarmed folks? You want to take rubber bullets and water cannons and throw concussion grenades at people? Do it through us. We're the people who has stood up for the Constitution. And one of them, I think, brilliantly said, we took an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So what that person was saying, what that veteran was saying was, the Energy Transfer Partners is an enemy to the United States Constitution. And I would agree with that, because these people would rather torch our civil rights and our human rights than stop the flow of oil from the Bakken Shale in North Dakota, which, as I said, is unnecessary and is one of those things that will spiral climate change out of control.
There are murals all over the Northwest that tell the story of agreements made and broken between tribes and the federal government. Do you think this will turn out that way?
I don't know. I mean, I think, look, this is a temporary victory, but the power of the people is never temporary. So we're seeing people who are not going to leave until finally this pipeline is defeated. And, you know, today was the day that the Army Corps of Engineers and the North Dakota governor was to say, you are going to be evicted from this protest camp. Today happens to be the birthday of General Custer. So the irony is not lost on the fact that just as Custer was defeated, so this pipeline will be. And that, I think, is really one of the takeaways to learn from this today.
You smiling, idealistic, not a speck of cynicism in you.
Well,
Josh Fox.
To be honest, you know, when you're on the front lines and you're staring down a militarized police force and you see people all around you, and I did this as a reporter. One of my colleagues, Aaron Schrody, shot in the back by a rubber bullet in the middle of an interview. You see people being tear gassed. You see people who are saying to police, we are praying for you, and they're getting maced and pepper sprayed. You can't do anything but smile when you see that this is actually working. It is a remarkable thing, because every day is a victory when you're in the middle of that.
Josh Fox is the director of Gasland, Gasland 2, and most recently, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. He recently returned from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota, where he was filming the protests there. Thanks so much, Josh.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
For 37 years, no American president has been cleared to speak directly to a leader of Taiwan. Since the U.S. normalized relations with Beijing, it's been forced to act as though a nation of 23 million people with a capital city, Taipei, about 3 million people, simply don't exist. This U.S. policy was compelled by China back in the late 70s after Nixon's opening to Beijing. Well, surely the stench of this don't ask, don't tell strategy for pretending things don't exist might attract some notice from the abnormalizer-elect, and it didn't take long. On Friday, President-elect Donald Trump, breaking 37 years of American precedent, accepted a call from the Taiwanese president, Tsai Ing-wen. The U.S. only formally recognizes the government of Beijing as China, and this is central to the U.S.'s relationship with China. Bonnie Glaser is senior advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Well, I don't think that the United States pretends that Taiwan doesn't exist, but there are certain procedures and guidelines that the U.S. uses to communicate and cooperate with Taiwan. In fact, I would say the U.S.-Taiwan relationship is quite robust. But yes, Trump is proving to be a very unconventional leader. He made quite clear in the campaign that he would not adopt traditional approaches, so I suppose we should not be surprised.
Is that an argument for moving the conflict between China and Taiwan forward? There's been such an incremental, glacial evolution of the relationship between these two places. Getting Trump in the middle of it like this does signal that, you know, people are going to have to change their worldviews a little bit.
Well, I think what Trump may be trying to do is reset the relationship with China, not just with Taiwan.
Right.
In fact, he has tweeted that China did not ask permission when it manipulated its currency to its advantage and built military outposts in the South China Sea. So it appears that this is part of a new strategy of pushing back against China. What's really problematic here is that Beijing may react very harshly, not so much to these tweets or even adjustment of policy on trade or South China Sea. But when it comes to Taiwan, this is very much a core interest. In fact, I would say China is neuralgic about Taiwan. And if the U.S. is seen to be supporting Taiwan at a time when it has a leader that is a member of a party that has long supported independence for the island, this can have dramatic repercussions.
Under no circumstances could we go back to the to China policy, right? I mean, there's no way to unravel 37 years of established China on the world stage Pacific diplomacy, right?
I think that would be very unwise, but I doubt that Trump is going in that direction. It's important to remember here that although the United States has a one-China policy, that it has not accepted that Taiwan is a part of China. So in the communique with China, the United States acknowledged China's position that there is only one China and that Taiwan is a part of China. So the United States deals with the People's Republic of China in the international community. It sees it as the representative of China in the United Nations, for example. But the United States has a very separate and strong relationship with Taiwan and believes that the sovereignty of Taiwan has yet to be determined.
Bonnie Glaser is senior advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Exxon and Mobil, offering Synergy gasoline engineered in Exxon Mobil's Formula One fuel lab. Exxon and Mobil, energy lives here.
The U.S. Supreme Court is looking at some strange-looking maps today. Two cases on redistricting up for oral arguments. It's the question of whether certain districts were purposely drawn to pack African-American voters into majority-minority districts, thereby lessening their overall representation in the state legislature or Congress. In McCrory v. Harris, the court will determine whether to uphold a lower North Carolina court decision which ruled that two congressional districts were artificially packed with minorities. And in Bethune, Hill, the Virginia State Board of Elections justices will consider whether Republican representatives in Virginia gerrymandered a dozen districts for the same purpose. In the Virginia case, the lower court ruled those districts actually to be legal. Richard Berfault is a professor at Columbia Law School who focuses on the laws of process in government and this very arcane subject, but we're thrilled he's here. Richard, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Is this sustainable, this current crazy drawn gerrymandered districts situation that the Supreme Court is going to be looking at?
Well, it creates all sorts of difficulties. And on the one hand, it really is in tension with some basic ideas of democracy. On the other hand, it's been very hard for the court to come up with clear sort of straightforward rules that aren't themselves incredibly political or incredibly uncertain.
Is that because it's not the court's job? It's the state's job to do this.
It's the job of the states to do it right, but it's very tempting for politicians to do it in ways they favor themselves. So it's unless you either take it out of the politicians' hands, which a handful of states have done through creating special districting commissions, which are at one remove from regular politics, or the court comes up with some sort of tight, manageable, clear-cut rules, which they haven't been able to do until now, we're going to continue to have this gerrymandering thing going on, and maybe getting more abusive as the technology gets better and as politicians are able to, practically down to the individual building, figure out how different people are going to vote and move them around. We're not quite there yet, but we're pretty far along.
Does the U.S. Supreme Court and the U.S. judiciary have a test for representative government, that if the population and the composition of the district should fall below a certain ratio, that it doesn't represent a representative district?
Well, there are basically three rules the Supreme Court has. One is equal population, and that's been the rule now for roughly 50 years. Since the 1960s, the Supreme Court adopts the one person, one vote rule. Districts have to be a pretty much equal size. They apply it very tightly to congressional districts, a little less tightly, but still reasonably tightly to state legislative districts. Second is that the districts can't be drawn to what's called dilute minority representation. You can't do it in such a way that it intentionally makes it harder for minority voters to elect their candidates. And that's been supplemented by a federal statute, the Voting Rights Act, that goes beyond just intentional efforts to what's called dilute minority votes and actually look at the effects of other measures which are not – you can't clearly prove intent. And the third issue, the third standard the Supreme Court developed about 20 years ago when it's just proved difficult to apply, is that you can't use race in a way that makes it so predominant that you create strange, bizarrely shaped districts or otherwise violate what are called sort of traditional districting standards like compactness, contiguity, that all the parts of the district connect, respect for political subdivision lines. So those are the three constitutional or statutory criteria that are out there. But those do leave a lot of wiggle room for politicians. And at least the last two on race sometimes come into conflict with each other. On the gerrymandering, the court has sort of had sort of two silos, two ways of thinking about it. One is on party gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering. And there they were reluctant to think about it. Then for a period of time, they said, we will consider challenges, but then they never found that any particular plan violated the gerrymander because they said it had to be really extreme. Then a case about a dozen years ago, the court split up and rejected the gerrymandering claim there, and four of the nine justices says we never want to hear a gerrymandering case. We don't think it's justiciable. It's capable of judicial resolution. The fifth justice in the majority, Justice Kennedy, says something along the lines of, I don't think it's justiciable now, but it might be later. And nobody knew quite what to make of that.
What's the issue that the plaintiffs are most weak on here?
Well, I think there are two cases. The challenge in both of them, and the Virginia case I think is tougher for the plaintiffs, is the argument that the court has said that if you can show that race was the predominant factor, in some sense what predominant means is one of the issues here, and so that the legislature basically disregarded most everything else, or the legislature subordinated everything to race, that makes it the districting plan unconstitutional. However, the court has said you can take race into account, particularly if you want to assure that there are a fair number of districts in which minority voters have a fair chance of winning. And the claim in the Virginia case is that the legislature did this in a very mechanical way. They said the districts that are going to be black majority have to be at a certain percentage, 55%, and we're going to make them all fit that, even though a few of the districts in the past were able to elect minority representatives with a smaller share of the black vote. And so the plaintiffs are charging this as kind of a unconstitutional packing, that they're putting an unnecessary number of black voters into these districts with the result of taking them out of the neighboring districts, and that has a partisan consequence too. The Supreme Court a couple of years ago in a case from Alabama said you can't be absolutely rigid mechanical. You have to think about the individual districts. But much of the focus in this case is just how much can you use a kind of a standard of 55% and without showing more, without showing that the specific districts were themselves oddly shaped. And so that's one of the tensions, just how much can a legislature just rely on a kind of a formula.
Or just drive through the district.
Yeah, I mean,
just drive around it. Try to drive around it.
Yeah, but that more that's the issue, I think, in North Carolina. The Virginia ones, there are some issues about whether they're oddly shaped, but the real focus is to what extent the legislature give just too much emphasis on getting all these districts to a certain number, a certain share of black voters. The North Carolina one is about this conundrum of how do you disentangle race from politics, mm-hmm. and say this was in effect a black majority. One of the two districts at issue, one of them was a black majority district, and they made it much more so. And it was clear that one of the reasons behind it was to make the surrounding districts, which had been Democratic districts, Republican districts, and it succeeded. And what was this about minority representation? Or was this about partisan gerrymandering? And if the answer is yes, both, how do you decide whether it's illegal, it's unconstitutional racial gerrymandering?
Richard Berfault is professor at Columbia Law School. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
A deepening tragedy in Oakland, California now. The death toll in what officials say is the deadliest fire in Oakland's history is in the dozens and expected to rise as authorities sift through the destruction at the artist live workspace known as the Ghost Ship in the Fruitvale neighborhood of Oakland. The fire, which engulfed the cavernous space, started Friday night during a party. One of those unaccounted for is a freelancer at our partner station KQED in Northern California. How are people responding, John?
Well, I think people are just responding with a lot of heavy hearts. We're seeing a lot of makeshift memorials near the site. There are several chain link fences around this warehouse before you get to the crime scene, or pardon me, the crime scene investigation. We don't know if it's a crime scene yet, and I want to make it clear we don't know. But there is crime scene caution tape up, and near those we see lots of flowers, lots of handwritten memorials. John, to be honest with you, there seems to be a little bit of disassociation going on. I spoke to someone who had escaped the fire yesterday, and it was almost like she wasn't there as she was talking to me. Like she understood what was going on. She logically knew that at least one of her friends had died and perhaps most likely several more. But she didn't seem all there. So I think there's a lot of unattended grief, especially for people who new survivors, new victims at this fire, and for those who survived, just barely making it out.
How big is this building?
It's about 10,000 square feet, 9,900 square feet. It's the kind of warehouse that you would see in the more industrial type areas of a city. This area of Oakland and Fruitvale is a place that is, just beginning to gentrify. So we're starting to see some houses that are being rehabbed. But this industrial place was the kind of place where you would, maybe see rows of sewing machines if it was not an art collective. So it's a very big building. It's a very old building. There's a lot of structural problems with it to begin with. And it's made it the actual structure of it and the faulty structure of it combined with the blaze. It's made it very difficult for first responders and search teams to make their way through this area.
Is it certified for residential living?
Absolutely not. And that's been one of the big contentions already. Not only is it not certified for residential living, we've been told, KQED has been told, that there's about 25 people who are living there. We have not confirmed that. The person who owns the warehouse says he was unaware of anyone living there. Now, we should say, like many warehouse art spaces that, again, are found in Los Angeles or Portland or, in the New York area, this one was essentially rented out to one person who then kind of subletted it to other artists. Many of them are struggling artists. And so this was a place where they could live and work. It was absolutely not zoned for it. And the person who actually managed this facility, a very well-known guy in the Oakland warehouse art scene, has kind of disappeared. So we can't get a lot of answers from him as this goes on.
Any estimates of what the peak occupancy of that building might have been on a typical night?
Well, I've talked to people who say that they've seen up to, like 600 or even 1,000 people.
Wow.
There. This is a very large building. That doesn't appear to be the case on this night. It appears that, we're estimating somewhere, and I want to make this very clear, just like we don't know the cause of the fire or the reason of the fire, we also don't know how many people were in there. But we're estimating, based on our eyewitness accounts right now, at about 100 people so far. There are still many scores who are unaccounted for who said they were attending this. And we should say that this art studio was, you know, creativity and imagination was encouraged. Well, creativity and imagination don't make for good fire escapes. There was only apparently a few entrances in because the artists had kind of created this kind of surreal labyrinth, this experience when you walk through it. And apparently, according to the people I spoke with, that's made it very difficult for people to escape. So, I mean, just a tragedy
all the way around, that's for sure. Yeah. Well, we pray for any information about your colleague at KQED. John Sepulveda is a host of the morning program California Report. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Exxon and Mobil, offering Synergy gasoline engineered in Exxon Mobil's Formula One fuel lab. Exxon and Mobil, energy lives here.
In the end, for Austrian voters, it was too slippery, a slippery slope.
I've never forgotten that. It's so deep inside me. I still remember it today. And now, a politician tells us, a civil war could happen? Impossible.
Gertrude, an 89-year-old Holocaust survivor from Vienna, speaking there. Voters headed to the polls with that on their mind on Sunday, and they largely repudiated the gains of populist right-wing politicians elsewhere in Europe to select the country's next head of state. Norbert Hofer, a key figure in the right-wing Freedom Party, conceded defeat to Alexander Von Bayen, the Green Party candidate. It was an even bigger setback in Italy, where voters tossed the entire draconian reform program of Matteo Renzi into the trash. He's agreed to resign. Alison Langley is a freelance journalist based in Zurich, Switzerland, and a lecturer at Webster University.
Austria is a tiny country that is a major exporter. That's what its economy is. So Austria is pro-EU. They need the EU to export. So they see it differently. Although Hofer kept coming out and saying, I will not try to get an Austrian exit, no one believed him because the Freedom Party always has been an anti-EU platform. And Nigel Farage, I mean, if you're asking about outside influences, Nigel Farage came out and said, yeah, vote for the Freedom Party and Austria will get out of the EU. And the Austrians were like, no, they didn't want that. And the other thing was, but I think even a bigger role was the idea of its place in history. And I think a lot of Austrians are so sick of being compared to Nazis. And when they saw that all the headlines and all the things was Austria is going to be going back to the Nazi era, they really started rolling it in. And what you see is a higher voter turnout, which is really interesting because it's all the people that didn't vote last time. They came and voted for von der Bellen just to say, no, that's not who we are.
Does Austria have a fundamentally different relationship with its history than Italy seems to in the embrace of a Mussolini-styled leader, but a real rejection here of all these changes?
Yes. I would say that the Italians really has a north-south divide. The northerners are more export-oriented. They're more pro-EU, and the southern Italy is not. So you see a lot of different factors at play.
One of the things that's interesting in Italy is the disillusionment among Italians with their governments of whatever political persuasion. Where does it go from here?
That's a really good question, because Renzi, 2.5 years ago, ran on an anti-establishment party platform. And he said he was going to come in and shake stuff up. And what he saw was, because of Mussolini and its fascist past, Italy's constitution is structured so that the power is very decentralized. And he found that he couldn't do the changes that he wanted to implement. And that's why he asked his country to agree to these changes. So what we're seeing is that Italians, they don't like the establishment, but they don't like change either. And this is why, I mean, just because of this crazy constitutional system that they have, where the federal government doesn't have a lot of power, that's why you keep seeing 65 presidents in like 70 years of Italian history.
Alison Langley is a freelance journalist based in Zurich, Switzerland, a lecturer at Webster University. She joined us from Zurich. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com.
She's a Fellini in Harlem. Julie Dash is a movie nut, has been since she was a kid. And it never occurred to her that anyone would stand in her way from becoming a famous director until they did. Her 1991 film Daughters of the Dust was the first movie directed by an African-American woman to receive a theatrical release in the United States, and the only film to date by a black woman that has been added to the National Film Registry. The movie's been restored and is out in theaters now. Dash was part of a group of young black filmmakers whose work was influenced by the civil rights movement, the riots in Watts, and the Vietnam War. The films and stories of her generation are a piece of history that Dash and her friends say they were always convinced they were making.
I was an avid reader of Toni Morrison, Tony K. Bambara, Alice Walker, Gloria Naylor, and I wanted to tell stories about the lives of complex women at pivotal moments in their lives, just like they did in the written form, in the novel. And so I was bursting at the seams to get on with that, you know, right after Daughters of the Dust.
What were the obstacles in Hollywood and in entertainment? Why so clubby?
That's a great word, clubby, yes. Hollywood is clubby because I believe they see themselves as the curators of culture. Therefore, if you present to them something that they've never heard of before or that it doesn't have anything to do with their personal or familial legacy, they're not really, really interested. They want you to tell the stories that they want you to tell, that they want to see, that they want to hear about, more about. And if you present something different, they like, you know, like, thank you for submitting, thank you for your time, adios.
What is the sense of audiences coming out of Hollywood, and how is that affected by a kind of racial myopia?
Well, I think we all know now very clearly that those exit polls everywhere are not quite accurate. They do think that they have their finger on the pulse of what's happening, what's trending, what pop culture is looking for, and in that same connection, they try to curate for that. That's why I call them the curators of culture. However, audiences want to see everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think they don't quite understand.
What in pop culture excited you about the changes that were afoot in terms of more diverse faces and stories getting on the air and on screen?
Nothing that I could think of when I was growing up. I didn't think about the media. Because we just weren't there. I couldn't see a present. I remember one night my mother waking us up to see a movie because there was a black person in the crowd, and that was an Andy Griffin film, A Face in the Crowd. There was a black family on camera. She woke us up. She ran in the bedroom and woke us up, and we all jumped up and ran out to look at the television because there was a black family on the screen. I'll never forget that.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
When you were growing up, what inspired you to believe that there was a place for you in this all-white world?
I never thought about it that way when I was growing up. I don't know. I pursued film because I had such a great interest in controlling the story within the frame.
What was the film that you loved when you were little? When you were younger?
I'll tell you, generally, I enjoyed films that I didn't quite understand.
Mm.
And I think that's why I try to make films that have complex characters rather than the easy sell, because it's, you could flip to any station and find the easy sell. I want to see things that take me away. That's why I love foreign films. And for, in many ways, people say that Daughters of the Dust is pretty much an African-American foreign film.
So you had a sense right at the beginning that the canvas was much larger than was being presented to audiences.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I was. Yeah. When you go into a theater, into the darkened room, and you want to, when you exit, you want to come out knowing a little bit more about the world, a little bit more about yourself, a little bit more about the potential of life itself and who you are. It's an experience.
How important, as you've watched this transformation in Hollywood, do you think it is for the healing and the development and maybe the maturing of American culture?
I think film is the perfect medium, film and television, the perfect medium for healing, for expanding, the expansion of knowledge, the expansion of ideas and hope. That's why it's so exciting to know that there's Netflix, Amazon.com, all of these other new forms of streaming video. And so it's new forms of streaming ideas and streaming new cultures that you've yet to visit.
And so many African-American producers and directors have taken advantage of this golden age. I mean, this is a crazy time for opportunities, it seems.
It's a crazy time, but there's still gender issues.
How would you describe them?
There are hurdles and minefields that you have to get through to still get a film greenlit, even if it's through one of these new video-on-demand agencies that or production companies. It's still extremely difficult because those particular production companies are going to the same agencies and pulling from that same pool of directors and producers and cinematographers that Hollywood is pulling from. So we still have to, you know, bang on a lot of doors.
What would you say is the most hopeful sign or positive sign of the changes that we've witnessed really over the last 50 years in Hollywood?
The most positive sign?
Yeah.
That one's easy. Ava DuVernay, Queen Sugar. In 6 months' time, Ava DuVernay has done more to advance women filmmakers than Hollywood has done in 100 years. She hired women directors to direct the entire series, black women, white women, Asian women. 6 months changed the landscape. It's phenomenal. There's been nothing like this that ever happened before.
That's director Julie Dash. Her 1991 film Daughters of the Dust has been restored and is playing in theaters now. Tomorrow we'll hear from another director whose career has spanned decades. Norman Lear brought African-American faces to television before any of his peers. My conversation with Norman Lear tomorrow on The Takeaway. The voice of 30-year-old bass baritone Ryan Speedo Green making his debut at the Metropolitan Opera this fall in La Boheme.
I'm about 6'4", 5", 300 pounds. I'm not a small guy by any means. I'm an object of fear whenever I walk late at night somewhere. I live in a building, a very nice building. Just the other day, I walked in to the elevator. Just so happened to catch a young lady. There was no button press on the elevator, and so I pressed my button, and she still didn't. I guess she was like, "Oh, she must be on my floor. This is the floor that I'm getting off of." And so I, right when the elevator opens, and I get off on my floor, then she presses her button to her floor. I was like, I just shook my head. Like, I mean, I couldn't get in the building unless I lived here because the doorman would not let me in the building if I did not live here. And she still was so nervous and scared that she did not press the button of her floor till after I got walked out of the elevator.
As an African-American man, Speedo's presence on opera's grandest stage is one story. Another story, how to get there from a childhood of poverty and hardships to a stint in solitary confinement. Writer Daniel Bergner helped Speedo Green tell that story in the new book, Sing for Your Life. Green and Bergner joined WNYC's Rebecca Carroll in one of our Uncomfortable Truths in conversation about the persistence of racial tension in America.
For a lot of people who say America's not great, I want to ask them, like, what is not great about this America? Like, what makes it not great? And then my second question is, when was it great? Because I would like to know, at what time was their America, their version of the great America, great?
You think America is great right now?
Compared to the America that my mother grew up in? Compared to the America my grandfather grew up in and my grandmother grew up in? Yeah, like, I mean, the idea that that a human being can love any human being that he wants to love and be married to whoever he wants to be married to, and that the fact that I, as an African-American man, can be married to a woman who is white, the fact that I, as an African-American man, could sing on some of the greatest stages in the world in a field that 40 years ago, 50 years ago, they would not let a black person to sit in the same seat as a white person. This alone makes the America that I live in exponentially great. And it's really important to know, like, you know, my, the first election that I was allowed to vote in, I voted Republican. I voted for McCain over Obama. At the time, I was the values that I thought I had, and I really hadn't experienced much in the world. There were my mother's values, and there were the values of people I grew up around. But one thing I learned to do is accept the choice that America makes. And, you know, I hope that people will come together, because America divided is not a good America.
If I can just add, reeling back to that moment in 2008 when you voted for McCain over Obama. So when you first told me that, of course, I was stunned. And then we spent a lot of time revisiting that moment. And there was another element, if I understood it right and wrote it right in the book, which was that you really felt like it wasn't okay just to assume that every African-American was going to vote one way because of race. Like, there were other things involved for you. And that was really a profound set of discussions for me. And then you had this intense moment where you hear outside this bar where you're a bouncer, this utterly racist college student carrying on, using the N-word about Obama, and you're enraged, and you want to teach him a lesson about using that word. And then ultimately you end up teaching his frat president a lesson about the complexity of what it is to be a human being. That actually, no, you didn't vote for Obama, but you still wanted to kick the crap out of this racist frat member who was carrying on in this hard way about Obama in the parking lot. And that, to me, sort of said it all. Like, your whole story is about breaking out of these boxes that we put people in, breaking out of boundaries, breaking, you know, expanding how we think of identity. Sadly, this election, because of the crude terms that the campaign was waged in, have sort of redrawn the most simplistic and angry lines. And like you said, I think it's going to be a while, but we're going to have to find ways to cross those boundaries again and communicate.
Daniel, this process, this project, I mean, what has it taught you? What have you learned in terms of engaging with Black America, really? Like, you know, a world, a family, a life, an identity?
Well, that is a huge question. You know, just how complex Speedo's life has been is really the most impressive part of this story. I'm just flashing back to one trip I took alone to Virginia to talk to people who'd known Speedo's high school voice teacher really well, who was African American. And this was a great little but very poignant story. So he'd grown up in this sort of working / middle class all African American community that had been established specifically because in that area of Virginia, Blacks didn't have a place like this where the homes were uniformly nice, etc. So they build this community on one side of a lake. On the other side of a lake is an absolutely identical white community. The white community, however, owns the lake, puts a chain up around the lake, and with signs facing the beautiful plate glass windows that the Black families put up. But when the Black families look out their plate glass windows, they see signs that say, keep out of the lake, no swimming allowed. Meaning if you're Black, no swimming allowed. Now, we have come a long, long way since that. But I'd be curious to go back to that community now, a few years since I've been there for the book, and ask them their reactions to Trump's election. I bet you that the shift caused by Trump's election makes that history much more resonant and powerful and revives it in a really palpable way.
One of the most important people in my lives, like the person who is closer to me than my family is my fourth grade elementary school teacher, who is a little short white lady, who has shown me more kindness and love and compassion and believed in me more than anyone other than my immediate mother in my entire life. No one has ever motivated me more to be better as a person, not necessarily as an African-American, but just as a person. And one of the first things she taught me in her class was the Martin Luther King speech, the I Have a Dream speech. As a white woman, she taught me this, and she made the white kids and the black kids learn this speech because she wanted all of us to know that in her class, we would not be judged by our color, by where we come from, by our past experiences of our parents or us. We would be judged by our current selves, by the content of our character. And I think for me, when a lot of the reasons why I don't act out or say something when I see people, you know, judging me by my size and my color combined, is that I feel sad for them because they're missing out on a human being who might make them laugh, who might make them smile. You know, they could be the hugest opera fans and not knowing that they're passing a pretty good opera singer. You know, I'm not the best, but I'm pretty darn I'm okay, and I love classical music, and they never know who they could be meeting, who could be their best friend, you know, or a person to brighten up their day or tell them a great story, and I just feel sad for them. So like when I walked out of the elevator and that girl pressed a button to her apartment because she was fearful of me or fearful of what I represented in her mind, I was just sad for her. I shook my hair in sadness to know that, you know, this is. You're missing out. You're missing out.
Ryan Speedo Green, Daniel Bergner, you guys are fabulous and amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That's WNYC's Rebecca Carroll in conversation with opera singer Ryan Speedo Green and his biographer Daniel Bergner. Bergner's new book about Speedo Green is called Sing for Your Life, and it's out now. Also an invitation. Who would you sit down and trust to explore some uncomfortable truths with in these surprising times? Visit us at thetakeaway.org to nominate yourself plus a guest to participate. We'll set up the logistics and even give you guidance on how to get the conversation going. Again, sign up at thetakeaway.org/truths. That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Audible, providing books for readers to listen to in the car, on the phone, or on other audio devices. From politics and parenting to bios and bestsellers, more at audible.com/listen. Audible, stories that surround you. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.